If you're going to live in South Dakota, there's a few things you ought to know how to do. From SDPB, it's Thursday, September 12th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, NPR has relaunched the podcast, How to Do Everything. We'll talk with the show's producers about how they find the answers to listener questions and how they apply that knowledge in their own lives. Then, How to Do Everything, a South Dakota edition. How to wear a cowboy hat, how to survive a rattlesnake bite, for real, and how to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Maybe. For real. We have sought answers from some uniquely qualified and overqualified South Dakotans. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. NPR is relaunching their podcast, How to Do Everything. It's half advice show and half survival guide. How do you cut your hair in space, for example? How do you know definitively if you smell not so fresh and no one will tell you to your face? Mike Danforth and Ian Chillig take your questions. Then they find guests qualified or overqualified to offer answers. Chillig says it all starts with a really great question.
We're always excited when somebody asks us something that we had not thought of. We're always looking for something that we can repeat later to our friends, the kind of things you would want to tell somebody when you weren't hosting a podcast.
How much is anxiety and how much is, you know, how to escape quicksand? We were brainstorming, you know, our own South Dakota tribute show to play along, how to survive a rattlesnake bite, how to not get gored by a buffalo, how to survive in your car in a blizzard. And we thought, boy, are we just anxious people? So where does curiosity combine with good natured, but also fear and anxiety that we all have that we're going to be in some situation? And how much are you playing with that human tendency that we all have?
I do think that's the stuff that kind of sparks your imagination, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like a couple of weeks ago, I was with my family and we were on a gondola going up a mountain. And Ian, that was one of the first things we ever did. Like, what happens if you get stuck on a chairlift? Mm-hmm. And my kids were nervous. And I think I remember the answer was, don't jump. Right? Or was the answer to jump? I don't know.
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah. That is the problem.
Yeah. But the fantasy of being the one in any situation who has the solution, mm-hmm. you know, the one who knows that you're supposed to take the headrest off of the seat in the car to break the window if you're stuck inside.
You're going to be that guy. So it's not just the fantasy of survival. It's being the person who knew the thing to do.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to be prepared for every contingency. Yeah. That's what it is. Who knows what kind of snake it is.
Yeah. And you know nothing. So you have to find the people who know something. How do you find experts to answer some of these questions?
Oh, see, that's the best part about our job is because we're producers for NPR during our regular lives.
Yeah.
We can call pretty much anybody and they'll answer the phone because it's from National Public Radio.
Yeah, they think it's All Things Considered, but it's just us. But by the time we're to the second email, they're hooked in.
And then how do you make it into a good story?
Well, I mean, I think when we're trying to find those people, we are often thinking, who is the most overqualified person to solve this problem? Like, you know, if somebody says, I need help learning to parallel park my car, we want the world champion F1 driver to be the one to answer that question. Or once someone on the first iteration of the show, someone called in with a question that he always arrived at a place first before his friend got there, and he wanted to know how to look cool when he was just standing there by himself. So we called up Henry Winkler, the Fonz, to give him advice on looking cool, and it was magical.
Mike, what would you add to that? Crafting it into a story that people are going to want to listen to once you've got the question, you've got the expert, and now you need to tell people a story that's going to stick with them.
Well, I think the element of surprise is really key. Like, you want to keep people hooked and keep them listening. And you really want to make sure that it's kind of quick and to the point. Like, there's a lot of good, like, scientists who have a lot of really fascinating information, but maybe aren't the best communicators. And so you have to find people who know what's cool about the thing they're doing and how to talk about it in a way that's engaging.
Yeah.
And we have great producers. Our producer, Hina, right now, has been helping us put together these first few episodes. And the job is find somebody who is so excited about the research they do or the field that they study that you're caught up in their excitement when you hear them.
Yeah. Is there a white whale of advice givers that you're looking for? Have you had a question that you just can't find the person who actually knows the answer to it?
Well, I can't think of anything right now.
I will say a real problem that Mike and I have both dealt with as people who host a podcast is, and Mike has a cold right now, and we are headed to the premiere of our show next week. And I want to find somebody who can tell me a 30-second solution to make it sound like you don't have a cold when you have a cold. And people say tea with lemon, tea with honey, that's going to help. But I want a radical, possibly dangerous solution to take your voice from cold to normal. And I'm sure there must be a Broadway actor who has this concoction and can share it with us.
Yeah. You want South Dakotans to send in their questions.
Oh, for sure we do.
Give us the spiel.
You can send us your questions. You can send them to us at howto@npr.org. Super easy to remember that email, howto@npr.org. We read all our emails, and we will do our best if you send us a question to find you an answer.
Yeah, we are on it. You mentioned being in the gondola, Mike, and not remembering.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time that the podcast has bailed you out of a jam where you got into something?
Absolutely.
Tell me that story.
Well, no, I can think of a couple different things. I always know one of the first things we did was how to know what side the gas cap of your is on your car. Most cars, it'll tell you where the fuel gauge is. That'll have a little arrow next to a picture of the car showing you where you need to pull in to get the gas. That's an easy one. I know one of the first things we do is how to revive a stale old bagel.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done this for any old, like an old baguette. I'll just try and repeat this, and Ian, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. You kind of run it under water so it gets wet. I wrap it in foil and then put it in the oven, and then the steam from the water kind of gets infused in the bread, and it just kind of revitalizes it.
Yeah,
I don't think
it's
you can do it
machine.
More than once. Yeah, but it works.
Revive your bagel. Ian, how about you? Stories that you've put into practice, other than looking cool while you're waiting for your friend, because clearly.
Thank you. Thank you for
skill.
Saying
yes.
That. One that I use a lot, and it's pretty mundane, I guess, but someone told us that when you are cleaning your house, when you're cleaning a mirror, wear a black t-shirt, because then you'll see all the schmutz on the mirror and be able to find it. It's a simple, brilliant thing that will make your mirror sparkle.
You can find How to Do Everything on podcast platforms. And if you have a question, send it to them at howto@npr.org. Having said that, once we discovered the How to Do Everything podcast, we decided to field a few questions of our own, seeking out experts for advice on how to do all things South Dakota. First, how to wear a cowboy hat. Bad news, not everyone in the state is getting this right, particularly, I am told, east of the river. The good news is, with instruction and a little practice, wearing a cowboy hat is a learnable skill. Jack Scholl is a hat maker in Belle Fourche and owner of the Weather Hat Company. He makes custom hats, including for some heavy hitters in Hollywood.
You pull it down on your head. My rule is the sweatband, the inside of the hat, should be like a finger width above your eyebrows and a finger width above your ears.
Can you tell when someone's wearing a hat that either they don't know how to wear or is the wrong size?
Oh, I notice it right away. A lot of people have hats that are too tight and they can't pull them down far enough. some people, I notice they'll buy a hat off the rack and you can see a gap around their temples. Hat isn't even touching their head. Every one of my customers, I measure the circumference of their head to the eighth of an inch, and then I have an architect's rule that I put around their head and get the exact shape of their head, and then I trace it on a piece of paper, and I have two-inch foam blocks that I trace that on, and then I cut the head shape out with a bandsaw and sand it so that when I got the hat sanded and ready to shape, I put that block inside and steam and iron the base of the hat to the shape of that block so that when you put the hat on, it's going to fit even all the way around. And I like to snap my fingers on the brim and get a nice thud out of it. If the hat's soft, you won't hear anything. But I like hats that are stiff and firm, because they'll hold their shape better longer, and they're easier for me to shape.
You have designed for Hollywood costume designers, including famously Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, where you did several hats for the principal actors then and one for the director. What about that experience has changed, if anything, your business today?
Not really. I've had people from around the country call and want me to make a hat like DiCaprio's. And when I tell them the cost, then that's kind of the end of it. They think that it's going to cost $100 and it's going to cost $850, you know.
Are there favorite hats that you have or a hat that you would like to make that you wish somebody would come in and order?
I like to do fedoras, but I don't have. In this country, there's not much of a call for them. I make one or two a year.
What do you like about the fedora?
Well, it's different. You know, I make the same black cowboy hat day in and day out. With the fedora, I get to be creative on the bow and the ribbon.
Does the buckle go on one side of the hat or the other? Does it matter? Is that artist choice?
The bow and the buckle goes on the man's left side.
Oh.
And the woman's right side. A lot of women's hats now, you know, these newer makers that mass produce them, a lot of them put them on the left. But traditionally, the women's bow and ribbon goes, or bow goes on the right. What I see a lot here is people come in that they've never wore a hat or don't know anything about it, and they kind of set it on the back of their head, you know, and they don't know how to handle the brim and the crown. Or they'll set a hat that's shaped, and you pull them down a little bit in the front. When they're like that, you set them down. You always set them on the crown upside down. And people that don't know will set it on the brim, and that'll flatten the brim out in time.
Solid advice from Jack Scholl, owner of the Weather Hat Company in Belle Fourche. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Humans have a long and storied relationship with snakes. They show up in literature and art and, in South Dakota, political campaigns. So, how do you survive a bite from a rattlesnake? Dr. Brooke Idy is medical director of the Rapid City Hospital Emergency Department at Monument Health.
I've been out here for about 16 or 17 years, and many years ago we had a really bad snake bite that came into our emergency department. And very sick. And so one of our specialists here said, maybe this should go to Denver or someplace else. And I got on the phone with the National Poison Control, who kind of laughed at me and said, you are our snake bite center for the country. Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Rapid City see as many snake bites as anywhere else in the nation. So we are the experts here. And so we've kind of embraced that. And I kind of embraced snake bites after that, kind of learning about them. And I've given some lectures on snake bite care and done some of this before and worked with our pharmacy department to develop our snake bite protocols. I think this year we've seen about 10 this summer so far through our emergency department.
Wow.
And that's pretty average for us to see that about that many a year. Then when people come to the ER, once they get to us, you know, we have wonderful medicines to really stabilize and save their lives.
When you hear these patients or their family stories, are there things that people are doing commonly that you could avoid?
Unfortunately, there are common things that we see in the emergency department. That's, you know, alcohol is a big thing. A lot of our snake bites have alcohol involved. We see it more. We see children that get bit more. We see elderly. We see some of those kind of things. But it's usually men making bad decisions with the aid of alcohol.
Do people know they've been bit by a rattlesnake? They know they've been bit by a snake. What is the first step to figuring out what just happened to me?
Yeah, so most people know when they're bit by a snake. We always see some, they say, I think it was a snake. But for most people will know, because a snake bite is initially very painful. And so the area that's bit, and it's usually the leg, although oftentimes we'll see in the hands too, people trying to pick a snake up or do something like that. But people know when they're bit usually, and they have a lot of pain with the initial bite. And that's kind of the first sign of the bite. The snakes that we have, you know, rattlesnakes are the only poisonous snake we have here, and they tend to let go once they envenomate their victim. So they'll bite and then they'll let go. And so that's kind of a typical thing. So they're not coming in with the snakes, but people usually know when they're bit by a rattlesnake because it's very painful. Most people know it was a rattlesnake. Most of our other snakes, quite honestly, don't bite. And when they do, you know, most people notice the rattles. The rattles are a pretty telltale sign of that rattlesnake. You know, their markings could be sometimes confused to some of our other snakes, but most people know it's a rattlesnake, but some don't. And so we kind of have to treat all bites like if they think it was a rattlesnake, that it was a rattlesnake. And then we kind of go through our algorithm here, which is to try to figure out how significant this bite is. It's said about 20 to 25% of rattlesnake bites are what we call dry bites, which means they don't envenomate. And so that's kind of a big thing right away to figure out, was it a rattlesnake? Then did this rattlesnake envenomate their victim or not? And so that's kind of the first part in our algorithm once they get to us. And of course, there's been a lot that's gone into it usually before they get to us, either by people in the field or EMS in the field.
All right. So what is the first thing? Do you need to try to keep the snake, get the snake? Does it matter at all? What should you do immediately when you get bit by a rattlesnake?
The first thing we say is leave the snake alone. Like, people want to bring the snake in and show us, and we don't want the snake, quite honestly, and we don't need that. And so, you know, more often we see people take photos of things, but that's not really necessary either. If you see it, tell us a rattlesnake, we're gonna evaluate like it is a rattlesnake. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, you know, with that is that initial field treatment of a snake bite, because usually when you're getting bit by a snake, you're out in the wilderness, although we have significant, you know, snakes right here in Rapid City, but usually you're outdoors somewhere. And so the first thing we want to educate people on is what to do if you get bit by a snake. Immediate action really is very little action, which is kind of ironic, but there's all kinds of, you know, urban legends and myths about what you do when you're bit by a rattlesnake. You know, there's the, you suck the venom out, and that's a big no-no. You're just causing more tissue damage. Some people try to put tourniquets on to keep that venom from spreading. That doesn't work either, and again, causes more problems than it does good. Some things that seem like they might be helpful, like ice, actually are not helpful in snake bites. And of course, the old hooking the jumper cables and electricity has not been shown to do anything for snake bites. Mm-hmm. So really what you want to do when you get by a snake is you want to put that limb in a neutral position and get yourself to the hospital.
How about this idea of having to stay calm or not run or not do anything that would spread the venom throughout your body, throughout your bloodstream faster? Myth or fact-based?
Yeah, that's kind of a myth as well. I mean, you're not going to be able to help the fact that you're going to have an adrenaline rush. You're bit by a snake. You're bit by a rattlesnake. And so obviously things like running or those things can cause more tissue damage. But for the most part, just in general, with any kind of injury, you just want to stay calm. It never helps to get yourself the adrenaline surge. It never helps to run when you have an injury. So really you want to stay calm. You want to remove, if it's to a hand, or you want to remove jewelry, because a lot of times there's swelling with these. You want to put that limb in a neutral position, and then you want to get in to get help. Because really the only thing that helps with a rattlesnake bite is the antivenom.
What's happening in your body the second that you get bit? What is the venom going to do to you?
Yeah, it's kind of a complicated thing. So the rattlesnake, there's different types of toxins from snakes. And all we have here is the Western rattlesnake or the Great Plains rattlesnake, or what we like to call the prairie rattlesnake. But what's happening with that is it's releasing toxins. The rattlesnakes that we have, the toxin is a hemotoxin. So what it's doing is attacking your red blood cells and your platelets. And so the biggest complication we see is that you'll have bleeding. Red blood cells will literally burst when the toxin hits them, and platelets will come together and adhere, and that causes clotting and bleeding at the same time. And so that's kind of the biggest risk with it. Usually it starts slowly. It's not going to spread that quickly. It's going to be a local reaction. So you're going to have pain at the site, and then you're going to start having swelling. And so when someone comes into our ER and says, I was bit by a rattlesnake, usually we look at the local area that was struck by the snake, and then we monitor that for a short time because we don't want to give the antivenom if we don't have to. Mm-hmm. And we kind of look, do we see progression of that swelling moving up the limb? And so that's what we're looking for, and that's what we're seeing. And if we see that, we want to act quickly because we can't reverse any of the effects of the venom. All we're doing is stopping it from progressing.
Oh, so what are the effects of the venom if it's not reversed?
It's going to be a lot of tissue swellings. It's going to get into the lymph node system and cause swelling throughout the limb. And then it's going to continue to work on the blood cells, causing this bleeding and clotting problems.
What is antivenom?
Antivenom has changed. Antivenom first came out in the 1950s. And the initial venom they had really caused a lot of problems. It caused a lot of serum sickness and made people really sick. And then we came out with Crofab, and I believe that was approved about 1990 by the FDA. And that was kind of our big breakthrough in antivenom. And that had a lot less side effects and acted to neutralize that venom and cause no more tissue destruction from it. We've progressed now. We're using a new medicine here at Rapid City Regional or Rapid City Monument Hospital called Antivip. And it's a kind of the third generation of this. And it's specific only to rattlesnakes. Its only approval for that is rattlesnakes. And the FDA approved that in 2015. It became available in 2018. And we were pretty quick to adopt that. We can give one dose of it and not have to redose it. Mm. For the original Crofab, it was a dose and then three more doses every 6 hours. Wow. And so it's kind of helped us in the care of these patients that we can give one dose and then monitor carefully. If they're having some progression still, we can give a second dose. But most people just need the one dose. So it means shorter hospitalization stays, less needle pokes for the patient, and it works very well for rattlesnake bites.
How likely is it that you're going to survive this, presuming that you can get to some kind of help?
It's very likely. As of a few years ago, there's about 5 snake bite deaths a year in the United States. So it's not something that has a really high mortality with it. Those are all bites that mostly didn't make it into the hospital. Mm-hmm. If you get to us, we're going to give you that medicine and you're going to do well.
Though it may be of some comfort to know modern medicine can halt the deadly spread of rattlesnake venom, it's something else entirely to have survived a rattlesnake bite. Jake Niedringhaus agreed to tell me his story.
It was June 13th, 2009. I was 13 years old, and my family and I were in Custer State Park in the Black Hills, and we'd gone out there every summer and did a bunch of hikes. You know, we went on a hike. It's an area called Round Park, kind of off Iron Mountain Road, and it's a hike we'd done before, and we actually went in there because I had elk hunted in there with my dad the year before. So it was a cool hike, and you'd see elk and buffalo and all that stuff. So my whole family was there, a couple of my siblings who were pretty young, but my mom and youngest sibling stayed back at the campground because he was pretty little. But at the time, cell phones weren't super popular, and you really couldn't get any cell phone reception out there at all at the time. But my uncle, Craig, brought his BlackBerry for an emergency, and he wasn't going to bring it. His wife, my Aunt Lynn, kind of convinced him to bring it just in case. And luckily he did, and I wish I didn't even have a cell phone now, but looking back, a cell phone saved my life. So we went on this hike, and we're probably a mile or two from a road, and the hike kind of takes us back, and we angle down to where we were camping at the Game Lodge campground. We were coming down a pretty steep hill, kind of a rocky hill with a bunch of different shrubs and grass and stuff all over it, and because it was early June and it was really warm kind of for the time of year, that was kind of one of the big factors as to why there were snakes out.
Okay.
So I had never seen one in Custer State Park or even ever heard of them being there. And we were walking down this hill, and I'm kind of off to the side away from everybody. We're just making our way down. And I stepped kind of in between a rock and some shrubs, and I felt something under my foot move. So I lifted my foot up really quick, and I just had tennis shoes and shorts on. And when I lifted my foot up, I saw a snake kind of lunge right at my right ankle, right at the inside of my ankle, and it bit me right on the inside of the ankle. And it was just like very surprising at the time. I didn't really even know what happened. So I start kind of running down this hill, and my dad sees me and he's like, "What happened?" And he thought I was getting chased by bees or something, or wasps or whatever.
Yeah.
He runs over, and I'm like, "I think I just got a bit by a snake." And I look down and you can see like 2 puncture wounds from the fangs, and there's a little bit of blood coming out. It was really surprising to everybody. And I'm like, "Well, we've got to get down this hill." And within 15, 30 seconds, I started to feel like really wobbly and queasy, like the feeling you get when you're gonna faint.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, I think, noticed that, and he picked me up and carried me down the hill. And within a minute, I was totally completely paralyzed, and everything has like started to swell up, not really my ankle because it got bitten right in the vein inside my ankle, which is, I mean, one in a million just in itself. It went right to my bloodstream and went directly to my heart, and it spread super fast just because all the adrenaline and everything that was, you know, pumping through. So we lay down on the ground. At the time already, I couldn't see anything, and I couldn't move at all. I could just hear. So I could hear everything that was going on around me, and it was kind of hectic. And one of my aunts that was on the hike with us ran back kind of where the direction we came from to try to get help at the road. And my uncle was able to get up on top of a hill and somehow got enough cell phone reception to call 911. Having a snake bite, usually they're not super severe, you know, so they were going to send an ambulance from, I don't know, Custer, Rapid City, and that was going to take a really long time. Luckily, my dad, having been in law enforcement and around like some situations where people are in bad shape, he recognized that and was able to convince the 911 operator that I needed help a lot faster than that. And she was able to get Life Flight started to our location. And that was hard in itself because we just kind of had a general area at the time. I don't think that they could really pinpoint the 911 phone calls like they can now.
Right.
Eventually a helicopter came and it was getting worse and worse. And I remember like just having a lot of pain, like in my stomach. And that was really the only thing that hurt. And later on, I learned that that was just from all of the internal bleeding. The venom really thins your blood and rather than clot it like some other snakes do. So basically just started bleeding internally in my chest cavity, and I couldn't feel it at all, but I was having a lot of convulsions, and they described like my skin had like, it basically looked like there was like worms under it. Like all my skin was just crawling, like all the nerves and everything were just going crazy. But eventually the helicopter got there and actually didn't see us at first. It flew over and, it missed us because we're kind of in a pretty wooded area, and eventually it was able to land a little ways away. Paramedics came, loaded me up in the helicopter, and unfortunately no one was able to go with me at the time. So it was just me and the paramedics, and my whole family had to kind of just let me go. Mm. And they made their way back to the campground and then eventually met me in Rapid City at the hospital.
So you're in an incredible amount of pain. You're scared. You're 13 years old. And now you're separated from your parents as well. Did you think you were going to die?
Yeah, I did. It's at the time, it was a lot to process as a 13-year-old because you just don't really know kind of what's going on and what to expect. I mean, I think we were laying there on the ground for, at least a half hour or so. Oh. And it's really hard to explain, but you kind of get to the point where you just kind of accept the fact that you're probably going to die. And I don't know if it's just your body knows that it's going to happen. And looking back now, I'm able to think about it a lot more and I remember it like it's yesterday, but at the time you just don't really know, but you kind of just come to grips with it and you get like I had a weird sense of like almost calmness eventually before the helicopter got there, that even if I were to not make it, that it would be okay. And it was really tough. At the time, it's hard to think about now, but I've listened to some other podcasts with people who've had near-death experiences, and they really describe kind of the same emotion and the same everything that I went through to a T, like much better than I can describe it. And it's very weird and almost impossible to describe. But when I was in the helicopter, I was kind of going in and out of consciousness at that point, and they couldn't really do much for me in the helicopter because they didn't have anti-venom or anything like that. But I remember the paramedics and they're saying that on the radio that I probably wasn't going to make it to the hospital. And that was really tough to hear as a 13-year-old. The hardest part was the whole time I was laying on the ground and not being with my family, I wasn't able to say anything to them. That was really difficult. And it's like you get to the point where you kind of accept it, but you just want to be able to, say something to them before you leave because you just don't know if you're going to see them again.
Do you remember? So then they're going to, you do make it to the hospital and they are going to send you to the Children's Hospital in Sioux Falls, correct?
Yeah. So, I was in Rapid for a decent amount of time. And
okay.
I think they gave me all the anti-venom they had which it was a lot from what I understand. I was still not able to see anything at this point. I could only hear, and I could hear everything that was going on, but I had a lot of, from what I was told, a lot of bleeding at that point. Like, I just, your blood gets so thin that you just start bleeding from basically every, like, orifice in your body. And I had to have, I think, two different blood transfusions, I think both while I was still in Rapid, and they ran out of antivenom, and they said I needed to be flown to either Sioux Falls or Denver. And because we're from Sioux Falls, they flew us to Denver on the plane. Luckily at that time, my parents were at the hospital. My mom was able to fly with me in the plane to Sioux Falls.
Okay. Do you remember hearing your mom for the first time after this? Or do you remember hearing your parents at all?
Yeah, I do at the hospital. I remember my mom being there. And she's a pretty emotional person.
Yeah.
And I remember her just, I don't know if she was in shock too or what, but she was very calm. And it was really reassuring to me that she was acting that way, and she wasn't freaking out or anything. I think that would have made it a lot more difficult that they were kind of able to just be there with me and, you know, and act in a way that made me feel better about the situation. And I remember getting on the plane to Sioux Falls at that point, and I started to feel better. And I remember being in the plane and being able to see at that point, like my face had, the swelling had gone down enough that I could see, just realizing, like, you know, at that point, like, I'm, you know, you're probably going to be okay. So on that plane ride, you kind of finally get the feeling that you have enough care and you made it, you know, potentially, and you're going to be okay.
Yeah. What have been the emotional and the mental impact of this? You just got back from elk hunting, so clearly it hasn't forced you out of the outdoors. It hasn't forced you indoors. But how have you managed the mental resilience after the trauma of that whole experience?
Looking back, I mean, there was a lot of things that it was hard to talk about for a long time just because of the whole experience. And you don't really realize, like, kind of like what the mental effect it has in you. Like, say, if it were to happen to me now, it would be much different and probably handle it differently afterwards. But I just try not to really remember it or think about it. And that same year we went out, you know, hunting and in areas where there's rattlesnakes and stuff. And I remember being like hesitant, as like my whole family was when we're out, like you just think about it more. And I would get like the phantom pain from it occasionally in my leg. That was kind of strange. And I would get the feeling that for really a couple of years, like that I was stepping on something and you'd feel it move, like when that originally happened. But after a couple of years, you know, it didn't really bother me. Really, you just have to think about it in somewhat of a positive way.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm deathly afraid of snakes or anything. Like, I've run into rattlesnakes and seen them since then, just because, you know, I am in the outdoors a lot, but it's not the snake's fault. I'm the one that stepped on it. So
if I were to say, how did you survive a rattlesnake bite? What would be the first thing to come to your mind? How did you survive?
The easy answer is just be careful where you step. Even when you don't really think it's a possibility, just consider the environmental factors. You know, a warm, sunny day, a snake's going to be probably out and in the sun and wearing gear that's more conducive to helping in a situation like that. I was wearing tennis shoes at the time and shorts. They told me that even if you're wearing boots, that they could potentially go right through them. Obviously, they make like snake-proof boots and things like that, but I guess more mentally, if you do get bit, and you're in a situation like that, I guess really the only thing you can do is just try to stay alive. It's really, I remember feeling just like it could have been really easy to give up. And I had my dad there after I got bit, and he just told me to keep breathing and just do whatever you can to try to stay awake and stay alive. And I think having that encouragement made a big difference.
A rattlesnake bit Jake Niedringhaus when he was just 13 years old. With a lot of help, Jake survived. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Most days in South Dakota are not as dramatic as a life and death battle to survive the venom of a rattlesnake. More likely, we face the everyday challenges of going to work, growing a business, providing for our families, caring for our neighbors. Which brings us to our final question of the day. In a state known for resilience, independence, freedom, what does it mean to pull yourself up by your bootstraps? We begin with bootmaker Mark Schumacher, owner of Schumacher Custom Boots and Saddles.
Well, here in Woolsey, it's a town of about 430 people. I've actually got a bootmaking shop right here. Basically, it's kind of almost a full-service leather shop in that I also build saddles and repair boots. So, but my main thing is building boots. I build, between 60 and 100 pair a year from scratch, and they're all custom order, made-to-order boots. The leathers run from a variety of things. I mean, we build common-type work boots for people that have foot trouble where they can't find boots that fit their feet. And I've had to work around different braces and things like that for different people. And then, of course, some of the folks just want something a little bit nicer or something that lasts a little longer. Most of my boots outlast a manufactured boot by about 2 to 3 times.
Wow.
Because we do build out of all leather, and we don't have any man-made materials in them, so to speak of. So,
how do you figure out what somebody wants in a pair of custom boots,
and
what you can give them?
That a pretty fair idea, you know. Some folks they want a pair of ostrich skin boots, that, you know, and they know what color they like and things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some people it takes maybe an hour or two just to kind of decide what they want. And I do have some customers that say they went on an alligator hunt or they went to Africa on an elephant hunt or something like that, and they want to get a pair of boots made out of the leather that they of the animal that they've shot, you know. So we've done that too.
How did you get started in leather work altogether?
Oh, I kind of started pretty young. I was about 12 years old or so, and the story I tell everybody is that I grew up in Iowa, and in Iowa they had a bounty on the pocket gophers that were in the state there. Mm-hmm. And so for every pair of feet off a pocket gopher, which of course you had to kill the pocket gopher to get the feet, you know, you took them into the courthouse and they'd give you a 25-cent bounty for them. And so I took that money that I made from trapping pocket gophers, which were kind of a nuisance to the farmers and stuff because they made big mounds on top of the ground and stuff like that, and plug up moors and made it rough to farm and things like that, you know. So if you got all these pocket gophers eliminated, you know, and your fields were a lot nicer.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I made quite a bit of money trapping pocket gophers, and I bought my first Tandy kit way back then.
Nice.
Which was just kind of a starter kit, and then it kind of just gradually went from there, you know.
How does a 12-year-old boy capture pocket gopher? They're fast.
You trap them.
Okay.
You learn how to trap.
I thought you were chasing them. I was like, that's pretty good.
No, you trap them.
That's also how you got your exercise.
Yeah. Well, they're always a lot of fun when you caught one because they were vicious, you know, and of course they didn't like being caught, and they'd snarl at you and try to bite you and things like that, you know. So yeah, it got pretty interesting time to time, you know.
All right, what exactly is a bootstrap?
Well, there's several different kinds of bootstraps. I mean, there's like in here we put on regular boot pulls, which is like a tab, you know, so that could be considered a bootstrap. Also, some of the boots, we put holes in them, so that's not really considered a bootstrap, but a way to pull your boots on. But probably the bootstrap you're looking for is the old-time mule ear, which we put those on quite a few boots, too. And those straps can be like the length of the whole top of the boot. In other words, if you had a 16-inch high boot, you'd put a mule ear on there that would be about 16 inches long. And those straps, you can just hang on to the end of them and kind of funnel your foot into the boot and pull them right on. you know. So a lot of people don't know what a mule ear is, haven't seen one, unless they watch a lot of old Western movies where there are boots out there that do have mule ears on them. So.
And are they off the back of the boot then?
No, they're not on the back. They're on the side of the boot, just like a regular boot pull would be.
Okay. Two on each boot?
Yep, two on each boot, one on each side of the boot.
Why would they have been that long?
Well, you didn't have to bend over as far to put your boots on, which is a lot of the clients that have gotten mule ears, you know, for the first time after they get them, that's what they want again. They want mule ears again because they don't have to bend over so far to put their boots on.
Nice. I like that. All right. So you've heard the expression to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Is that possible? Is that a thing a person can do?
Well, it's kind of like starting out with a shoestring, you know. So, I mean, basically, maybe the two terminologies are probably a little bit different. When you start yourself out with a shoestring, you got no financing, no nothing. And basically, when I started this business, I started out, you know, pretty much on a shoestring. Yeah. But as time went on, of course, then I had to pull myself up by my bootstraps, which meant that you got up in the morning and you pulled your boots on, you went to work, you know. So
I'm taking that as a yes from the bootmaker in Woolsey, that you can.
Yeah. There's you know, it's like any person that, say a person was, to me, you know, I mean, this is, of course, my opinion, but to me, to pull yourself up from your bootstrap is like that 40-year-old person that decided that he needed to change in life and went back to school to learn a new occupation or a new skill.
Yeah.
You know, it's self-improvement, you know.
Well, we called you for an opinion because you make the boots.
Right.
So then do you want the mule ears then if you want to do this, or do you want the boot pulls? What's your preference?
For myself?
Yeah.
I actually put holes in all my boots, so I can pull them on with the holes. But
good to know. A mystery solved.
Yeah, that mystery solved, yeah.
There's a bit more to this mystery, of course, and that is in the phrase itself. Prentice Clark is associate professor in the Department of English at the University of South Dakota.
My first step was to look in the Oxford English Dictionary. And you see an entry from 1891 that says, you know, a bootstrap is a strap that is sewn onto a boot to help in pulling it on, or a strap looped around a boot to hold down the skirt of a woman's riding habit.
Oh,
so there's the literal, you know, bootstrap.
Mm-hmm.
Another entry in the Oxford English Dictionary is from 1922, and it says this is a colloquial phrase to pull or lift yourself up by your bootstraps, or to raise or better yourself by your own unaided efforts. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of colloquial meaning, right? Is pull yourself up and raise yourself by your own unaided efforts. I also wanted to ask students in my American Literature Survey class, are you familiar with this phrase? What does it mean? And students, they said, work hard. They said, when you fail, get back up. They said, get it together. So that was students, their sense of the meaning. But I wasn't totally persuaded. And so I did a little digging, and I found a number of 19th century examples from 19th century newspapers that use the phrase in a very different way.
How so?
A specific example I have is an American journal newspaper called The Working Man's Advocate in 1834, makes fun of a man who is named Mr. Murphy, who claimed to have discovered perpetual motion. And the joke that this newspaper tells is, you know, it's conjectured now, and this is a quotation, it is conjectured that Mr. Murphy will now be able to hand himself over the Cumberland River or a barnyard fence by the straps of his boots.
Mm.
So obviously it's impossible to actually physically raise yourself over an obstacle by your bootstraps.
Because your feet are weighing them down.
Because your feet are weighing them down. How do you actually lift your whole body weight with your own hands from your feet?
Yeah.
You know, physically impossible.
All right. So it begins with a different definition than what we have today, is what I'm hearing you say there.
Absolutely. There's another really revealing example that comes from the Chicago Tribune in 1862. And this is a quotation from the newspaper. "The hopeful individual who expects to raise a weight vastly beyond his strength belongs to the same class of fools with great expectations as he who promises to lift himself by his bootstraps."
Aha. Did your students have a thought on this?
They were quite surprised. And then one student actually mentioned a political cartoon that this student had seen in the 20th century that makes fun of the phrase precisely because it is impossible to lift oneself, you know, to lift yourself up by your bootstraps. So there was one student who was sort of aware, like, wait, maybe I've seen this somewhere else. And it was sort of, the phrase was made fun of.
We're fools if we think that this is something we can do entirely on our own. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the phrase morphed into something that a story of self-reliance, a story of independence, a story of, you know, giving yourself a pep talk or giving somebody else a pep talk? What happened?
That's what I haven't entirely been able to track down or figure out. I would imagine that there's sort of multiple reasons or ways in which the expression has changed. When I looked in the Oxford English Dictionary in 1922, it cites the phrase from actually James Joyce's book Ulysses. Mm. And there is a description there of people who, quote, forced their way to the top from the lowest rung by the aid of their bootstraps. So it seems to change in the early 20th century.
Huh. Well, Emerson is self-reliance, right?
Indeed. One of his most, I think, misunderstood essays and topics.
Help me understand it more. So what does Emerson have to say about this, even though he never uses the phrase?
I think for Emerson, self-reliance isn't simply relying on, you know, relying on one's own self, one's own will. I think it's a form of moral integrity and an absolute awareness of oneself and one's position in the world. So, and particularly for Emerson, meaning you as an individual are connected to many, many other individuals, which makes it all the more important for you to live a life of moral integrity. Mm-hmm. So it's not entirely relying on yourself. It's actually relying on or being incredibly attentive to your connections to many other people. Testing in that condition, what is ethically right? What is morally right? What does it mean to conduct one's life well in this particular situation?
How are we to live?
How are we to live?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You mentioned that sort of the, you know, what you've been working on is the question, like, how to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do I do it? How do I wear a cowboy hat? How do I pull myself up by my bootstraps? And I think what's just so interesting is that, you know, in the 19th century, that phrase is used and understood as a metaphor for attempting something impossible and foolish. But in the 20th and 21st centuries, the phrase is used and understood as a metaphor for relying on one's own skill and effort to improve one's situation. And so in a way, like answering, you know, how do I do it? How do I pull myself up by my bootstraps? Maybe it's learning to think metaphorically rather than literally, right? Literally, I can't pull myself up by my bootstraps. But if I think of that expression as a metaphor, then it's if I face a fence or an obstacle, I can work hard and get myself over it. So it may not be literally, I can't, you know, lift myself up by my bootstraps. But if I think metaphorically about it, yes, perhaps there are ways in which I can help myself to get over particular obstacles.
Yeah. We're not so foolish after all.
Perhaps not so foolish after all.
If you want to reach the producers of the NPR podcast, How to Do Everything, send an email to howto@npr.org. If you have a question about how to do everything with a uniquely South Dakota flair, send an email to your local public radio program. We're in the moment at sdpb.org. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.